If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. And the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Can we trust science?
Why is that important in a functioning society?
And are scientists easy to talk to?
This is For Tech's Sake, a co-production from Silicon Republic and the Headstuff Podcast Network. We're your hosts, Jenny Darmody
and Elaine Burke. And today we're going to talk about science communication and public engagement with science, which sounds really dry and boring when you put it like that.
Yeah, but it's not. It's not. And that's the problem with people thinking that, because it's actually really, really important to engage people with science and learn about scientific concepts, because the more you're informed and the more understanding you have about these things, the better you can grasp how the world works.
Yeah, and like that's still a long-winded way of putting it. Like, I cannot think of like a sexy phrase to put this. Maybe in the episode title, I'd have cracked it by then. But like, yeah, understanding how science works is good, but also understanding how you can challenge science when it should be challenged as well, if you have that understanding and that background.
Yeah, and that is really important, because science isn't impervious to misconduct, and it's not impervious to, like, you know, science as it's published is not automatically perfect, and it's not automatically without problems. You know, it's also got whistleblowers as well, the scientific community. I actually interviewed a Dutch scientific integrity expert last year called Dr. Elizabeth Bick.
Oh, that was a really good interview. I really
She was great. She was so interesting, and she was talking about this very thing. So her whole work focuses on detecting like photo manipulation in scientific publications. She's known for identifying more than 4,000 potential cases of improper research conduct. There's a couple of reasons why this happens. You know, there's like the plagiarism or fabricated images or just pure sham science, which sounds very bad, but like really there's a few reasons behind that. Firstly, there's a massive pressure to publish scientific papers among the science community because it furthers their career. So there's a lot of pressure to publish and kind of rush papers and things like that. And, you know, publish things that are very much like breakthroughs and, you know, that kind of extreme language.
You have to use that language to get it and the press release and then get the coverage of it. And then
to get the sexy comms, you know. Another issue is that institutions and academic publishers are not necessarily as quick to react to when the data is questioned or, you know, when investigation should be raised. They might not be that quick to look into it and stuff like that. The data is already out there. You know, it's just a kind of a backseat kind of thing. But there's another major problem in recent years, which I found really interesting, which was bad actors like paper mills, which are essentially like churning out sham scientists, basically companies that sell completely fabricated papers to authors who need them again for their career. So all of these issues lead to problematic research, problematic scientists getting out there, and it's Elizabeth's job to sniff them out essentially.
Okay, and we can read about that on siliconrepublic.com, I presume.
Yes.
But like, definitely thank God for people like Elizabeth, because the work that she's doing ensures that science can be trusted, because we have people like her doing the checks and balances. And even in an age of misinformation and disinformation, but also where you have that publisher perish culture, and by a science backed by compromised sources, like science needs skeptics, essentially. And there are obvious issues when you have a society that can't trust science, that rails against science and experts. Like, you see that in anti-vax and COVID deniers and all that crap. But we also see people making very public dummies of themselves sometimes from a pure lack of understanding, I have found.
You have found. You sound like you have an example.
I do. I came across this because of Collie Ennis, who also has a podcast. He's a zoology expert, specifically interested in little critters. So if you're not into creepy crawlies, maybe don't follow Collianus or anything like that. But he was tweeting about someone complaining about the little meadow that's been allowed grow in the front entrance of Trinity.
Oh yeah, like a natural rewilding.
Exactly, yeah. And it looks fantastic. Now, it looked really, really great during spring and summer, but we're now at that, we're in August now, we're getting into that autumnal phase for...
Yeah, flowers are dying.
Yeah, things are going to seed. Like literally, that's the phrase. It comes from nature.
Yeah.
And someone was tweeting about how it looks like a derelict property now and like that this isn't going to like solve anything in terms of biodiversity. And A, it does. Collie Ennis gave all the backup to that. But he was trying to explain to people that like this idea we have that like, oh, when we do the wildflower planting and it looks nice, so then that's great, isn't it? But if it then looks ugly, which is actually part of its natural process, well, then it's a problem. And it's just like fundamentally not understanding how plants work.
Yeah.
It really annoyed me. It really just wrecked my head.
Yeah, but then like putting that out there, like, you know, like furthering that message of like, you know, this looks terrible. And, you know, this is where the good science communication comes in, where you explain why things work the way that they do, and that kind of public engagement can stop people making a show of themselves, essentially.
And that's actually a huge motivation behind doing the podcast.
Yeah.
Our podcast for Texic. To stop people making a show of themselves.
that is our MO.
Yeah. But really, it's about helping this whole science communication stuff. Like, yeah. We speak to experts, we try to give context to things that are trending in tech and science, and so that people are better informed. Because whether it's a miracle drug or a silly app to turn your face into a Barbie, it's better if people understand these things and make informed decisions when interacting with them.
I mean, the Barbie generator makes me sad because I already know why you're coming after the Barbie generator.
It's hoovering up people's faces, yeah, to put in a database that will probably be sold on to third parties. And I would say that has the potential to impact on your life if you go into that blindly just because you're like, Barbie.
Yeah, and just capitalizing on that. And it's just because everybody wants to look like Barbie,
yeah,
in the generator.
Listen, I'm on the Barbie wave. I've seen the film. It's
this Barbie's worried about her data.
But there is a bit of a milkshake duck kind of cycle to these tech trends. Like, you see the tweets quickly veer from, oh, look at this cute app that turns you into a Disney princess. And then it's like, the app was actually owned by North Korea and now you've been pwned. Like, yeah, your data's on the dark web. Good luck.
We are suckers for a face-changing generator. And also just online quizzes and stuff. I think those come
age
up as well.
Detectors, yeah, so you can slack people off if it gets it wrong. But that's the thing. Like, a bit of understanding goes a long way in how we engage with all this stuff. But I don't think it's enough to be told how things work. So that's where public engagement, a non-sexy term, is hugely important. And it's like best practice as a dialogue model. So the learning has to go both ways. Scientists learn from the public as much as the public learns from scientists.
Yeah, and that's really the ideal, because like there's a lot of science communication that's just one way. Like, it's very much like the scientists are telling you things like the public can access and read scientific journals and things like that. But if there's no dialogue and there's no back and forth, then there's not necessarily a lot of room for that understanding piece. And scientists can be guest experts. We can have scientists on our podcast. There can be scientists who even, you know, run their own radio shows and things like that. But again, as much as it's important, it's still one way and it's not as much driving that, you know, discussion piece. And people can't share stories and stuff. And, you know, people can share stories online. That's also a thing that happens and discussions can happen there. But is that the best place for it?
The way online discussion is going?
We've had these discussions.
Bit of a shit show.
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah, things can get co-opted by, you know, groups with bad motivations and stuff like that. Like, it's a difficult place to try and have a reasonable conversation.
The shit show. Days. You could just say shit, yeah, show. It's all right. But a good example, so that it's not all bad, is the Choosing Our Future public forum that was instituted by Science Foundation Ireland a couple of years ago. It was essentially like a mass public debate about living through the COVID-19 pandemic, the lessons that had been learned and things like that. And Science Foundation Ireland have actually done similar things since, like in previous years. In 2021, I think they launched the Creating Our Future initiative, which was similar. And it saw 10,000 ideas on which to base Ireland's next science and research agenda. And it smashed right through that. Between July and November of that year, it got 18,000 submissions.
I wonder how much of that was helped along by the fact that people got a bit more scientifically conscious through the COVID pandemic, because basically science journalism was kind of front and centre for a while there. But that's great. Like, literally inviting the public to engage with science in a meaningful way. Like, that's the whole point of this. That's what works. That's the best practice.
And it worked because of how much, like, it nearly doubled the amount of submissions that it looked for, which I think is, I find that very heartening that the public did that they responded to that so well.
Yeah, that's really good. And events are another way that you can put people on location with experts, learn a little bit about what they do, discover things, challenge, ask. Like, that's the really good stuff. So we have a guest who knows a little bit about this. We're delighted to be speaking to Dr. David McKeown. David is one of the founders of Dublin Maker. He also ran an annual event called Science Hack Day and is the engineering manager of Earthsat 1, Ireland's first satellite. We're also going to talk a little bit about that. To put it briefly, he's a rocket scientist. You may also recognize him from RTE's Big Life Fix. He's a superstar. He's also my arch nemesis. And let's get into it. So, David, it's great to have you here.
Great to be here.
Yeah, we're in the same room and we're not going to kill each other. It's all going to be going very cameras. Professional, very well.
Do I need to be concerned about the rivalry in this room?
We love each other, really. But just to start from the top about this whole maker movement, so you definitely would just find yourself as a maker and you're a big part of it. So what is a maker and what is the maker movement?
Yeah, so, well, a maker, it's a very broad term for anyone who makes something, which it's just too broad. So I guess the idea is kind of inventors. And when we talk about the maker movement, more about your kind of your bedroom inventors or your backyard inventors. So people who may not be even professional engineers or scientists, but who like to tinker around stuff, which is kind of what we all love to do as kids and then kind of grew up and then maybe got serious and kind of forgot how to do it. And kind of has a few parts to it. One is that you either take kind of technologies that exist already and try to make them better. So you hack them, right? So, for example, maybe you have a toaster and it pops up and you get annoyed because by the time you have two sized toasts pop up, by the time you butter the first one, the second one's a bit cold. So you open up your toaster and you put in a circuit that delays it so the second piece of bread comes up. So that'd be one thing. You've kind of made your toaster better, maybe just for yourself to see how it works and that kind of thing. But then you tell people about it. That's the second part, right? So you put the instructions up. And if you have this toaster, here's the circuit board. Here's how you make that. And you do it. Here's the tools you might use. You know, maybe it's a 3D printer. Maybe it's all this kind of stuff. And it's that kind of thing. It's a sharing of tools and ideas more than even just making stuff. So that's the maker movement, which kind of came and went. It's probably about 10, 15 years old where it started. It kind of started in hacker spaces, which are places where you can have a membership and go and has tools and do work there. Magazines that were kind of helping people share this, and obviously blogs and digital. And now it's mainly YouTube stuff. You know, if you want to find out anything, you go on YouTube. And I guess there's loads of maker channels there.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I call it YouTube University. I think a few people are using that phrase now. Look, we're not recommending anyone like sticks a fork in the toaster or anything like that. But it is...
We'll plug it out first.
Yeah, it's a real hands-on definitely kind of movement. And it definitely seems to attract a lot of scientists, a lot of engineers, but also people who don't work in those areas and are just curious-minded types, I guess.
Yeah, it's all about curiosity. It's that idea of kind of opening stuff up, but avoiding warranties is a good way to look at it, not to be scared of doing that. But it is broad, and each country kind of has their own thing. Ireland has a kind of new tradition of crafts and stuff like that, and that all falls into it as well. So people, especially the mix-mash of technologies where you might have, you know, clothes or jewelry or fashion and bringing electronics into that or kind of improving it that way, or even just keeping some of these crafts kind of alive where, you know, you have a lot of these community groups that are up in like church halls and community centers and all that kind of thing going around, and they're all like, they wouldn't be calling themselves maybe makers or that kind of movement, but there's always these groups and people love it. So how do we kind of make people more aware of those things, and how do we get, you know, maybe a knitting group talking to an electronics group or a robotics group talking to a music group or whatever? How do we bring that together? Because overall, that creates a better kind of culture and vibe in the city. And that's kind of what it's about, but kind of, it's not about making sure everyone's super, you know, knows everything about physics or science or knows exactly how their phone works or whatever. But it's curious that they know a little bit about it and maybe, you know, go and do more. And that's kind of contagious. So if you see someone make it, and that's why we do these events around that, is to kind of make people come and talk to the people who are making this stuff, see how they fail all the time. Because we have a lot of stuff where we just show the shiny thing and it works and it's perfect and it's all great. But that's not how it works. You know, you do make lots and lots of mistakes. Being able to talk, you talk about the dialogue between people, and you know it's great for someone to be able to, you know, a scientist or an engineer or just this kind of maker, kind of go, here's prototype one, burned down the house, you know, here's prototype two, you know, only half the house got burned down, 3, 4, and now here's this really cool thing that works, and just kind of show, you know, because it's too intimidating sometimes to find the product of things. So the process is what's all about.
And I love it as a concept for, like, it is public engagement with science when you think of, like, maker movements and stuff like that, because you are, people are learning about fundamentals of how things work. Like, even if that's, like, the tension of your knitting stitches, because that's, like, physics, and there's also a lot of maths in knitting and stuff like that as well. So, like, really giving people practical things that are engaging with science. I love it. And one way that you do it and actually bring all these different kinds of makers together is through Dublin Maker. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so Dublin Makers, it's a community-run event, it's a volunteer event. So it's run by myself and three others, Tomas, Jeffrey and Laura. And we've been running it for 12 years, just a long time. And the idea of this was to bring kind of all these mixed of community groups together, or anybody who's working in maybe, you know, science education on their own in their bedroom, and have just an eclectic mix that we bring together. And then we do all the kind of advertising and stuff to get people to come in. And it's a free event. So there's no barriers to attend or do it. This was the idea. So we've been running it in different locations. So we started off running it on the physics lawn in Trinity College. Then we ran it in Merrion Square for many years. And this year we're moving to Richmond Barracks in Inchicore. So at that event, you'll have around 50 makers. And it really is an eclectic mix. So you will have robots, you know, big fighting robots that you can control. But we will have weavers and felting and iron jumper making. And we'll have the library, and we'll have AI robots, and we'll have just a complete mix that you don't really know from stall to stall what you're going to see. The people on the stalls are also there, giving their time for free to show off these things. And in a way, one thing, it sets them a deadline. You know, if you ever start a project and you kind of get, you know, this kind of curve where at the start you're like, yeah, I really want to make stuff. Oh, it's great. I'll finish that next week. And it's like 6 months and staring at you from the box. And you're like, so it gives you the makers kind of a deadline to finish things and show it off. And then talk about the things they love and maybe get more people interested in their club, whether it's cosplay or making props or, you know, these things. But they have their own communities they're very passionate about. And it gets people in there. Yeah, so we've been running it for many, many years now. And it's always been a great success. We get 10,000 people come along. And yeah, it's a real family day. We get a lot of, you know, it's some of these events also, you get it, it's like it's for kids. You know, it's for five-year-olds, or, you know, it's for teenagers, or it's for adults. And ours is very kind of across the board of it. And what we kind of see is, you get families, and maybe the dad or the mom are kind of pushing the kids forward to go ask that man about amateur radio or something like this, right? And they go and they you know, do the demo, and we're always about, it's hands on. You talked about it's hands on, you know, so it's just like, you know, we tell people you're going to get jam on your stuff, like people like the show it off. There's going to be hands on your things, but then from behind the kids, to like the mums and the dads are asking questions, you know, as well, because they're curious about things going on, and we get lots of feedback about, you know, kids going home and then wanting to do, you know, science kits, or like, why don't we build a catapult, or, you know, this kind of thing. So overall, you know, we love it. We don't, it's non-profit. We don't take a penny from it. And we just do it every year because we think it changes kind of how people feel about making in a very, yeah, it's not showing them scientific papers or journals. It's much more, you know, low level, curiosity driven kind of stuff.
And what are some of the standout kind of Dublin Maker projects and showcases that have been there over the years?
They're all good.
You don't have time to list all of them.
No, I always forget them. Well, we always had we have big robots. We had them again this year, and we kind of created a boxing ring around these. So last year we had these recycled, kind of made from like gas canisters and stuff, and they could be controlled by robots, and they were punching like that, and the kids are going mad just around this kind of fight. And we had an MC, like a boxing ring thing like that.
Robot Wars, I love it.
So we basically have Robot Wars this year. We have a 9x9 meter kind of Robot Wars ring, and then the robots can be controlled from outside the ring by kids or whatever, so you can get your to do without building the robot, do it yourself. We have that stuff. We're talking about knitting earlier, and we have had the knitters and the weavers. I was talking about the mix between technologies. We had a Twitter knitter, which was guys in the Tog hackerspace, Trina and Becky, who got a knitting machine, one of these old kind of, you know, big traditional knitting machines, and then added motors to all the kind of bits that you would have done by hand, and then hooked it up to the internet so it could knit out tweets as it came through. So if you did a hashtag Twitter knitter, then it would knit out your tweet automatically. So sort of that. I mean, it's just irrelevant. It's just for fun. It's just show you can do it and to be creative. You know, it didn't solve any world's problems, but I mean, it's pretty cool kind of stuff. But yeah, even those, you're just being cigar box guitars. We have the amateur radio guys. We have, just amazing things. One guy made, there was a guy last year. He had a tiny little stall, and it was just this piece of electronics, just a button with one key on it. So he was I think, a Spanish guy, or French guy, or Italian guy. But he had that C with the little curl at the end of it.
Cedilla, yeah.
Yeah, right. And he said he was getting sick of being in work that no one would spell his name correctly. So he created just that one key with a USB thing, so you could add it to your laptop and just press his key, and he was just handing them out. And he made a box like it was a product, and like this, and it was just a whole kind of joke that he made.
I love that so much.
It's just like completely pointless, but he's gone and built the whole thing, and he would share and open source it. Those ones, prop makers have come with like the blood and all the, you know, the silicon stuff, and kids are running around with fake swords and this kind of stuff, and you're like, yay. Forges, metal forges and wood turners, all that stuff has been really cool. Really cool when you see this, like, a kid with a spinning piece of wood in front of him and like with a little gouging out wood, and it's just wood chippings going everywhere. You're like, this is amazing, you know, because it's not something you do get like anywhere else, I think, or at least this mix of them, you know. So you can go from that, from the wood turning to electronics. We have a repair cafe this year. So you want a repair cafe?
Great.
Yeah, so talk hack space again around that. So you can bring any, if you have you tried to make your toaster different and you broke it, you can bring that and they'll fix your toaster. So you bring it along and the guys have, tools. They'll also teach you as much as possible how you to fix your toaster. But yeah, people come and bring on, around furniture, electronics and like Xbox controllers, and they open them up and clean them out and they're working again and this kind of stuff. And it's, again, it's just showing people that, you can fix and improve your stuff.
Well, if it's a gaming cartridge, you just have to blow on it. I think that's all.
Fixes everything,
yeah, for sure. I love that, though. I love the repair cafe element as well, because it's like what goes back to what you said about, makers not just seeing a finished product that's too overwhelming, but like failure and mistake and the whole like a scientific or a technology process is figuring stuff out. And as you said, maybe setting the house on fire, then setting half the house on fire, and then setting none of the house on fire.
Yay,
would be great.
Success.
Yeah. But also the repair movement is a really important part of like making anything to reduce the waste along the way.
Yeah, yeah, I think it's a good gateway into it, actually. I think if you have a fear of your technology, I don't know if I don't know if people are really scared of it, but they're scared of opening things. Definitely, you're like,
I'm scared of opening things.
Yeah, but like,
you weren't with a Nokia. You used to bust those.
Oh yeah,
open all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, a set of screwdrivers would get you quite far, and you can and. When you open things, make a lot more sense when you actually open up kind of products. You're like, actually, it's not as complicated as I thought. So unplug them first, as I said. But apart from that, there's not much. If it's broken already, there's not much you can do.
If you can't break it more.
Yeah, you might fix it. But, you can change screens and phones, and you can do, sometimes it's just a fuse, and sometimes it's just, you open it up and a wire is just hanging off. And you're like, that wire needs to go back in that place. You put it back in, or you solder it back in, and... So basic skills like that, like soldering electronics, when you melt it, that can be learned by, it seems like really scary, but it's hot thing to metal, melty, yeah. It's fixed, and you can now go fix loads of stuff then.
It can nearly be addictive. You taught me it at a science hack day, and I was like, for hours then that night, I was like, is there anything else that needs soldering? It
was so cool. That was just a lead fuse, was it?
Yeah, it was just, I'm in a little badge with the soldering.
I can solder badge.
I still have it, and it's displayed in my house. But like, realistically, if you're tinkering with all these things so often, how many times have you shocked yourself?
Yeah, I've shocked myself a couple of times. I shocked myself twice. But I was actually at e-waste hackathon. So we were making musical instruments from just e-waste sort of stuff. And there was a disco ball there and it wasn't working. And I was kind of hacking around with it and I tested to see if it worked. And then I tried to work on it again. I shocked myself in a disco ball. And then I pretty much did it. maybe 30 minutes later again, I said, probably should stop working on mains electricity.
That does sound like your first hit single, though. I shocked myself with the disco ball. Yeah. I really like the sound of that. Yeah. But I wanted to bring that up because I wanted to showcase how stupid a rocket scientist can be.
Okay.
Because, yeah, you're tinkering with things and you shock yourself. You're a dummy. But also, you're a rocket scientist. So that's really cool. You're literally the paragon that people use to depict intelligence. Like, it's not rocket science. Well, it is when it's your day job.
But it really is all about making mistakes and working on, you know, great teams of people. It is about that. It's just making mistakes, and we make them all the time and just admit them really quickly. And it's just like it's just part of the process. You know, it really isn't like everyone just knocking out the park. It's like, but being able to take that, like that, you go, oh, I think you might be wrong, and you're, oh yeah, I am wrong. Thanks. You know, it's just a thanks. Like, it's, you know, and yeah, you have to build, sometimes you just have to build prototypes and mess them up before you figure it out.
And to bring that into some of your other work, so aside from being this fantastic events organizer with a team of people that are also brilliant at doing this, you have your day job, and you do loads of other things. And one of them is helping to bring Ireland's first satellite to fruition. So this is AirSat-1, which is a CubeSat. So let's start off with, like, maybe what the hell is a CubeSat?
Yeah, so CubeSat is a nano satellite. So it's quite a small satellite. I mean, people think satellites, they think maybe really big, I don't know, size of a car, something like that. So a CubeSat is generally a size of like a shoebox, that kind of thing. And it's a CubeSat because it starts up with units of cubes. So 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. That's a 1U CubeSat, one unit. And AirSat's a 2U unit. So it's 20 centimeters by 10 by 10. So it would fit in your hands and you could carry it around. So it's been built in UCD over the last 6 years. I work with, it's between engineering and physics. So I'm the engineering manager. It's student-led and student-built in that way. So it's PhD students, some master students, and they've been around long enough to become postdocs and have been working on this from scratch, from nothing. And now we have a fully functional working satellite that we're just waiting for launch. Yeah, it's brilliant. It's been an amazing experience just working with some really clever people on it. So, yeah, it's going to go. It goes up into space. It's going to go whatever 500 odd kilometers up and stay there for maybe 10 years and do some science.
And kind of bringing it back to like that public engagement, science communication side of things. I think we've spoken about this before on the podcast. Like, people love space. Like, it's definitely something that gets people excited when it comes to science. Like, Penny sells NASA t-shirts now. Like, that's how cool space is. Why do you think that is? And like, it does get challenged. Like, people are like, why do we spend so much money on sending rockets to the moon and stuff like that? But it's also still something that really captures the imagination of the public more than any kind of branch of science, I think.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. I do remember a colleague of mine giving a kind of space talk, and at the end, this like kid puts their hand up and they just go, space and dinosaurs, and then just sit down, you know, and that's it, just space and dinosaurs. You know, it's pretty cool.
Yep, adorable and accurate.
No real question.
No.
So it is a great way in, and we've been doing stuff with schools, and we had an AirSat comic book, and we've been doing lots of talks and all this kind of stuff, and we're using that, and we're trying to use it as a platform to get people interested in it. The idea of, it's a really good question that you're like, space, we have other issues on Earth, is the usual thing. Like, while, like, you know, you're sending that thing to space with your gamma ray bursts while, you know, my grandmother's in hospital and waiting on a bed or something like this, right? And it's, you know, a legitimate question. But how it works is, and it's unfortunately, yeah, it's public engagement. It's a hard question to answer shortly. So let me try my best. But basically, our space industry in Ireland generates money, right? So for every euro we invest, say the European Space Agency, we generate about 4 euro more. So the net income to Ireland from having a space industry and running all this stuff is positive. And that's the money then we put back into schools and hospitals and stuff like this. The money that we spend on things like AirSat also just go into the education of these students and like that. We don't attach that money to the rocket and send it off into space. It gets spent here on Earth, and it's a stimulus and creates jobs here as well. So it's worth it for this. You know, the science is one thing. If you're interested in that, we learn more about our universe and gamma ray bursts. We learn more about these coatings, and we learn more about turning the satellite around and stuff like this with our control systems. That's what one side of things. But overall, if we don't, as Ireland, have a high-tech industry with, you know, we do all this stuff. We get people educated up to really high level, and we want them to have high-tech jobs that generate lots of money. And this is kind of part of it. And that's, if we don't do that, we're just going to slump off the economy. You know, we fall behind. There's lots of money to be made in space if and small countries like Ireland, because Scotland and Belgium and all these other small countries that are similar, New Zealand with Rocket Labs, are creating, you know, just billion euro companies in Scotland who are space. So what, if Scotland can do it, why can't Ireland do that? Here's our opportunity to jump on board and push that and have Ireland. It won't be the world leader in space, but we can carve out our niche in what we're good at and it can be a big part of our economy.
We're just pulling you out of this episode for a moment to remind you that we are part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, and that means there's a whole load of podcasts from Headstuff that you might like to sample.
And one of those podcasts is Fireside, which is a lovely, what I like to call a soft podcast. It's tales of Irish folklore, legends and other fabulous stories told by host slash bard Kevin C. O'Lahan in an incredibly atmospheric way. So if you're looking for a nice, soothing story time, I highly recommend it. Even talking about it is making me feel really soft and smooth.
And here's Kevin to tell you more, and you're totally going to get that vibe from this, I promise.
Fireside is the Irish storytelling podcast. Every week you'll hear tales of mythic Irish gods, Arthurian knights or Norse Vikings. There is folklore from Ireland and around the world, and even historical legends like Brian Boru and Grainne Whale. Whether from poetry or prose, lyric or legend, if there is a good story at the heart of it, you'll find it here. I'm Kevin C. O'Lahan. I'm your host and Fireside Bard. With over 150 episodes and rising, there has never been a better time to join us by the fireside.
Okay, wasn't that great from David, my arch nemesis? He is lovely.
He is lovely. He is. You have the nice arch nemesis.
I know. Even my enemies are delightful. You can hear lots more about AirSat 1 and space tech development in Ireland in our bonus episode next week. But like, back to Doublemaker, there are actually lots of events out there that are doing public engagement with science. God, we really need a good term for that. But doing that in a unique and out-of-the-box way, like Bright Club.
Ah, yes. Shout out to Bright Club, which is a comedy night for nerds. Sexy science, sexy funny science.
Yeah, and I am going to be doing Bright Club.
Yes, you are.
In September. So yeah, we'll definitely be sharing information on that. It will be in Whelans. They also do events in Galway as well. Definitely check them out. They have researchers on stage doing stand-up alongside actual comedians doing stand-up. So the price of your ticket fee will actually cover some real comedy and then some desperate losers like myself trying their best.
Nerd science. Nerd yeah. Fun.
It's great fun. It really is. I've been in the audience for many events. I don't know how much fun it's going to be for me on stage at one of the events.
It'll be so fun for the audience, though.
We'll see.
Can we bring popcorn?
I mean, like, do whatever you want. I mean, all I can say is I don't know what I'm going to talk about, but Elon Musk is more than likely going to get rinsed.
Like, yeah.
That's probably
good. I mean, it has to happen. But it's so good that we have events like this and we really see the science is all around us concept come to life at those kind of events, like how like all these things are so cool. And like, as you said, like knitting has maths in it and physics, like all that stuff is just really cool. And the ecology of wildflower meadows and stuff like that. So like, and Lego. I just love like how Lego inspires so much like engineering and intuitive and inventiveness and that. And like, It's a great time. Minecraft can kick off education in coding. Like there's so much science and technology in like really like basic get your hands on things kind of
exactly like touch points that are actually tactile. Like yeah. You really are getting involved, and it's so great to see that stuff. I mean, even right now we have a film about a scientist smashing the box office. I'm talking about Scientist Barbie.
Of course you are. Oppenheimer who?
No, but like, I'm really actually excited to see Oppenheimer as well. I've already seen Barbie, but I'm gonna do both. But like, it's great. Like when you have sectors like entertainment engaging with science, or gaming engaging with science, or STEM, I should say, opening up to all aspects of science, technology, engineering, maths. they get things wrong, even in these media, well, then that's kind of even better because it starts the conversation, then the experts can contribute to the conversation, and then it gets more dialogue-y and responsive. Like, that's that best practice model of this public engagement.
Yeah, and I love that it breaks down that wall of, like, you know, science stands over here with the absolute truth and fact, and there's no discussion to be had with it, and the sort of, you know, breaking things and making mistakes along the way and stuff, because that's so important for how you get public people to be interested in things like that. But also, you know, the engagement piece is important because of, and you talked about this in the intro about, like, misinformation that's out there, and particularly with science and stuff. But I actually had a fascinating conversation recently with Dr. Catherine Richards-Gallini, who is the editor of Healthcare Publications. And you can read about this interview on Silicon Republic. But I was chatting to her about science and health communications, because that's kind of their MO of, like, making the science digestible and understandable and things like that. And I brought up the topic of misinformation. And she actually, like, turned away from, we have a war on misinformation and things like that, where she pressed upon the importance of spending more time and money actually fueling, engaging with people and making them understand the true science better, and being able to have that kind of health literacy rather than spending all this money and time and energy talking about all the misinformation that's out there and how we stamp that out and how we block it and how we censor it and things like that. I mean, first of all, she was, like, very much against, like, we shouldn't be blocking people off from reading things. We should be helping them to understand what they're reading. But also, I mean, it's essentially a game of whack-a-mole anyway. Like, you can't get past stuff that's lies. I mean, like, we no longer, like, I don't know if we ever did, but I'm sure there's still places where you can access information about the earth being flat.
Yeah, I'm sure that's out there.
But the engagement is strong enough that we know that it's not. So, like, then it doesn't matter. Then you're taking the power away from the misinformation. So I think that whatever way we get the dialogue to happen and people are not afraid of engaging with science or sounding stupid. I feel like people don't want to talk about science and, like, the depths of technology in case they sound stupid. And I think it's important to remember that no question is a stupid question.
Yeah, that's definitely what we need. Like, it's engagement. It is. It's back and forth. It's just getting involved. Talk to a scientist. They're nice, except David.
Get stuff wrong, though. That's, yes. And it's important to realize that. Yeah, yeah, and that's okay. I mean, even he messes things up and he's a rocket scientist.
Literally a rocket scientist. It's so cool. Yeah, I think it's all about public engagement. We just need a better name for it. Like, catch science, like you catch feelings. No, I'm sorry. I'm out.
Is that the... Sometimes I think if you just say it in a good voice, like a Will Arnett style voice, like Psycoms, like the Batman voice, maybe it'll sound cooler.
Okay, you've got it. You've nailed it. Well done.
That is. Did I go to a good Will Arnett?
I loved it.
Psycoms. That's our whole thing. It's like the kid, just space and dinosaurs. You just say it as a statement with confidence.
Oh my God. It's the kid. The kid nailed it.
Yeah.
Space and dinosaurs, you guys.
All that matters.
Over and out. Thank you for listening to this episode of For Tech's Sake, and thank you to Dr. David McKeown for sharing his expertise with us. You can follow David at DJ_McKeown on Twitter. Yes, I said Twitter. And find out more about Dublin Maker at dublinmaker.ie. We really encourage people to pop along next month and see what it's all about. It's in Richmond Barracks in Chicor on Saturday, 2nd of September. We'll also share some starter links about ErSat-1 and other things we talked about in this episode in the show notes.
For Tech's Sake is a co-production from Silicon Republic and the Headstuff Podcast Network. Follow us at Silicon Republic and at For Tech's Sake Pod on your platform of choice. And please subscribe and share and let us know what you think.
Next week, we'll have a bonus episode featuring our full uncut interview with Dr. David McKeown. This is exclusive for Headstuff Plus community members, so do look into signing up. Otherwise, we'll be back to you in a fortnight.
This show is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network, a hub for the creative and the curious. Shows are produced in association with Headstuff and the Podcast Studios Dublin. Find out more or become a member at headstuffpodcasts.com.
If you want to support this podcast and get a full ad-free episode, sign up to Headstuff Plus.